This is KHOY Community Radio's Local Talk Wednesday, edition of the COVID-19 Response. I am one of your hosts for today, Pat Schlarba, together with co-host Susan Franson. Thanks, Susan, for being here with me this morning as we broadcast KHOY's COVID-19 Response.
Thanks, Pat. I'm always glad to co-host with you. And today, I know you have an especially thought-provoking interview with Carolyn Raffensperger about science and how it's used to guide policy. Let's listen to that before we hear our other guests with their take on how to affect policy.
Well, welcome, Carolyn Raffensperger. How is your day with the COVID-19 response these days?
Oh, it's such a mix of sorrow and perplexity and at the same time, close observation about the world around me. And I thought maybe we would talk about what science is this morning.
Yes.
It was actually prompted by a couple of things. One is the governor of Iowa, Governor Reynolds, has been talking about how she uses data to make decisions. And so I thought it would be interesting to unpack how people use data to make decisions and why her invoking that has been perplexing to me. She says they're looking at data. But as a person who thinks about what science is, I want to know what data she's relying on, what decisions she's making in response to it, and why. So I trained in archaeology in graduate school, and archaeology is really the study of material culture of humans, so arrowheads or styrofoam cups or what's in people's garbage or, you know, the pueblos of the Southwest or the pyramids at Teotihuacan, those kinds of things, you know, and they're evidence of the culture that we live in. And archaeology wants to be science. There's scientific components to it. Since archaeology, for the most part, you're not relying on the written word to understand the history or the behavior of people. So the question of how do you know becomes a really important issue in archaeology. And fast forward to my career now doing environmental law and policy, and it is almost all science and ethics based. So we combine science with ethics. Science can tell us what's going on in the world, but it can't necessarily tell us what to do. And right now we're hearing a lot of debate about science and do you believe science or do you not believe science? And I think that that's kind of an idiotic way to frame the question, whether you believe science or not. What's your experience? How do you experience, say, climate change? Are you noticing or observing changes in the weather? One of the reasons that I felt probably a little bit of grief this morning was I don't think this weather pattern is normal. It does not fit my long experience of living in Tallgrass Prairie. The number of days that we've had clouds over the last 3 weeks doesn't feel like a normal summer pattern to me living here. So when we look at what science actually is, a wonderful friend of mine said that it is a conversation with the world and that it is the observation, the posing questions to the world, to the natural world. So, you know, looking at a line in my backyard, there's a very sharp line across the tree line below which there are no plants. And then you've got grasses and you've got garlic mustard or you've got, you know, any number of woodland plants when I look back at the forest edge at the back of my yard. And, you know, what causes that sharp a line? That doesn't look like a natural line. It looks like something a gardener would do to make the garden look pristine. Well, it turns out it's the deer. Mm-hmm. That's the level that the deer can reach. So what does that line tell me? And it's called a browse line. And what does that tell me about the natural world? You know, so I think of science in two kinds of main categories. One is the science that tells us how the world works. You know, we can figure out gravity, or we can figure out why some fish species swim from the ocean up to a freshwater stream to spawn. We can ask the questions of the natural world. Why do some birds migrate? And where do they go? And how do they know where home is? So there are questions about the natural world. And then there are questions about technology. Is this technology safe? Is nuclear power safe? Is a vaccine safe? Or we use science to develop technology. So we've used science to develop wind or solar power. And those are kind of different. You know, asking whether a technology is safe is a funny question. You know, safe for whom? At what dose? How big? Is it safe long-term? You know, there are many, many questions. So is this pesticide safe for humans? Well, you know, maybe not. Yeah. Who's asking the question, and what are we going to do with the information? So when I listened to Governor Reynolds, that she's using data, it made me think of biologists that I was working with on something called the precautionary principle. And the precautionary principle is based on the idea that we're going to face scientific uncertainty. We don't know what the outcome of climate change is going to be. We don't know some of the variables around COVID-19. We don't know whether people will develop immunity. We don't know how long some of the symptoms will last, whether it will recur in one person over and over again over months. Exactly. And we're starting to figure out some of that. But precautionary principle talks about that uncertainty. And it says, in the face of uncertainty but the likelihood of harm, you take action. And at this meeting of biologists, we were meeting with marine biologists who were studying dolphins. And they were noticing that there was a sharp decline of dolphins in a part of the ocean off the east coast of the United States. So what they did was they determined what actions they would take if they found a certain number of dolphins. And if they found, so if they only found two pods, I'm making this up as a hypothetical, but if they found two pods of only 10 individuals, they would think that they had a population problem, and they would ban fishing during certain months. If they found no dolphins, they would have a blanket ban on fishing for a year. And if they found 10 pods, each with five individuals or, you know, a larger number, they would take no action. So they set up what they would do based on the numbers before they went out and did the testing, before they counted the number of dolphins. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that that would be a much more reliable way for us to trust what a politician is doing based on COVID-19. Mm-hmm. If she said, I am looking at the numbers of hospitalizations, the number of deaths, and the number of new cases, and I'm looking at it geographically. And if we see this pattern, then I will shut down all activities that require people to get together in groups of five or more for 2 weeks. You know, if she said something like that, then I would know what I was relying on. But just to say, I'm looking at the data, tells me nothing. Tells me nothing. So I've been thinking about this conversation with the world, and especially looking at the browse line. One of the things that it tells me, or suggests to me, is that there are too many deer out in my neck of the woods. We now have a new fawn, which is a wonderful thing. You know, it's new life. It's a great thing to have new life. And yet, there are no major predators in my woods. And so I'm looking at that browse line, asking what it tells me. It doesn't tell me what should be done about it, but it does tell me that my woods are having a tough time. The plants are having a tough time right now because there are too many deer in that backyard. Well, that's my hypothesis. So I know that you trained as a biologist and that you were always in conversation with the natural world. When you saw the decline in certain birds, how did you approach that question to the natural world? How did you look at the decline of, say, the osprey or migration patterns of white pelicans? How did you think about that as a scientist?
Well, their presence and absence says a lot, and presence meaning good and absence meaning probably not. And then looking at the habitat and then the quality of the habitat, trying to determine how the individual species fits into a guild, if you will, into a group of water-loving species, which the osprey would be included, or the bobolink and the grassland nesting birds, essentially looking for these indicator species that have a earmarked type of habitat type, and their presence or absence would be kind of where you would start with your surveys, and then numbers after that. And species diversity always means a lot. There could be a whole lot of a very few things and essentially be indicating a degraded habitat base. But diversity, there's strength through diversity. So a variety of species in a grassland would definitely be one of the parameters of your data that you would be scrutinizing or looking at.
Yeah, and it seems to me that the COVID-19 has brought about more interest in science of the natural world. Public health, and especially of infectious disease, is one of the great disciplines of the natural world, as is field biology. And in fact, probably infectious disease could be one branch of field biology if we considered our relationship with the natural world to be one of the most primary and essential relationships of all time. And it strikes me that one of the questions that biologists and public health experts are always asking is, what boundary do we look at? So if we're only looking at Cedar Rapids around COVID-19, we might not get very interesting information. But if we look at this whole state of Iowa, or if we look at the whole Midwest, we're going to get very different kinds of information and ways to think about it. Just as, we're going to get different information if we're looking at the bald eagle and we're only looking at the Mississippi River. If we're looking at the Mississippi River and the Des Moines River and the Missouri River and on, we're going to get a different picture of what's happening with the bald eagle. Mm-hmm. And it strikes me that the boundaries that we set in our inquiry can be really, really interesting. I did my master's thesis on a site on the Apache Reservation in Arizona. What I did was I looked at the boundaries. If I only looked at that one site, I got very different information than if I expanded it out into the watershed, into that larger world. So if I only look at the browse line in my backyard, I may not get as much information as going around and looking at my entire neighborhood and looking around at woods nearby and then further out. What's the population of deer in my little community and then broader? And it has important implications. Yes. It has implications for the health of the forest. So too many deer and we start getting more ticks. We get those diseases which are called zoonotic diseases that move between species, humans and deer, or birds and humans, or mice and humans. And these diseases move between species. And so what does that browse line tell me about the larger health of the community and all of the questions that can spiral out from that particular piece of information?
The impacts that the deer are having beneath that browse line has adverse effects to a lot of nesting warblers and songbirds. When the deer are essentially suppressing that brush or that cover, it really has a negative effect on nesting songbirds.
When I was teaching the philosophy of science, and there's a whole branch of philosophy called epistemology, which is the study of the philosophy of science. How do you know? Who knows? Mm-hmm. What do you know? And one of the experiments that I had my graduate students take, they were all doing environmental policy, and I had them go out and predict where they would find birds' nests. And I had gone out and mapped bird's nest out on the college campus that I was teaching at. This is just a couple years ago. So they had to predict, you know, where, what do they eat? Are they ground feeders? Are they insect eaters? Figure out where mother or father, where those birds would build a nest based on these different criteria, which they didn't know birds, but they had to learn something about why a bird would put a nest on the drain spout of their dining hall. And why would one build one way up in a tree? Why would one build one on the ground? And what's the difference in those fledglings? Yeah. So they had to predict and then go out and test their prediction based on their prediction, what they had guessed. And then they could test that. Right. Was I right? Through data. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But those are things you can do at home. This is the time of year when birds are nesting and fledging, and you can go and see. Where do birds build nests? And you can ask yourself, why? Why did they build it there? Why did they build it out of those materials? And begin to have your own conversation with the natural world. Learn to observe. Learn to ask good questions. Mm-hmm. A good question is one of the most powerful tools that we humans have been given. It's so much more powerful than any tool that we could imagine. Mm-hmm. To ask a good question. And you can ask a good question of the natural world. And it may take you time to get an answer. Mm-hmm. But the one gift that we're given is this conversation where you can ask and receive. Mm-hmm. And you can give back based on that information. You can respond in ways that help the world be healthier, be more full of life. You can help set policy. You can evaluate what politicians are telling you based on, you know, the kinds of questions and the kinds of thinking that you are empowered to do.
Thank you, Carolyn Raffensperger.
We've been listening to a conversation between Carolyn Raffensperger and Pat Schlarbaum about how she suggests ways science can guide public policy. She's talking about the natural world, but our next guest, Betty Andrews, president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP, will continue the conversation about how information can guide our policies. Hello, Betty.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us today. And about the data we're talking about, we hear that a far larger percentage of African Americans have been diagnosed with COVID-19 than their proportion in the Iowa population. And we thought that you'd be able to tell us what that means and what can be done about it.
Sure. So absolutely. I'd like to start by telling you what those numbers are. However, and I wanted to be really up to date. So first of all, I want to thank you for allowing me to be on your program today. But I wanted to make sure that I was really up to date with our stats today. And I looked into today's numbers. And lo and behold, I am finding that the governor's website, which was previously reporting our race guidelines, now there is an issue with the portion of their site that is reporting those cases by race. And so we do not have the current numbers. And I screenshotted that and we'll be taking that up with the governor's office. But I'm just finding that out now. But I will tell you that typically the cases for African-Americans, and then also they do show the positive cases by ethnicity. So by ethnicity, and that includes our Hispanic or Latino, Latinx brothers and sisters, by ethnicity, it is showing that the Latino percentage of that is about 25%. Which is extremely high. And the African-American percentage trends similarly closer to about between 15 and 20% of the positive cases, which is pretty high considering that the African-American community is about 4% of the Iowa population. So we're disappointed not to be able to have those numbers in real time as of this moment, but we will definitely check in to make sure that the website is updated. With that, though, initially, these figures were not being reported at all, and that was extremely disconcerting to the NAACP. And being president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP, we have about 30 units of the organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. So our with our 30 chapters, and we represent a lot of the things that deal with the livelihood and the well-being of African Americans. And for us not to have those numbers was pretty critical. Early on during this pandemic, there were a number of cases that were emerging, or a number of information points that were emerging from across the nation that showed that African Americans were getting this virus at numbers exponentially higher than our white counterparts. And so we petitioned, and I say we, the Iowa NAACP, petitioned the governor to release these numbers. And we were grateful that just a few days later, those numbers were released by race. And those numbers being the number of people infected with the virus. We are still looking to have the number of people that are have died with the virus by race, but we do appreciate that this was made a measure in spite of the fact today that we are having difficulty with the website. So those numbers are critically important. When the African American community is often affected by adverse things exponentially more, and this was the case when those numbers were originally released. So at that time, being 4% of the population, we were more like I think it was 13% of the positive cases, and those numbers have trended up since, and they ebb and flow a little bit, but they it suffices to say that it's two to four times more than the general population.
Well, I read somewhere that Iowa has far more cases in proportion than other states. So our stats are really bad. Worse than the way we thought they were. They're worse comparative to other states.
You know what? And unfortunately, when I'm dealing, because I deal a lot with issues of race, and I don't think it's something that most people can comprehend when you tell people that this is 300% worse for a particular community. That is not necessarily comprehensible. People just don't understand it. And yes, Iowa is horribly disproportionate for our communities of color. We have seen high numbers elsewhere, but in Iowa, we are very concerned. We absolutely in, for instance, the Waterloo area, those numbers are off the charts, and in other areas as well. It is definitely a challenge for us.
The prison population is also disproportionately higher. Does this have anything to do with the number of African Americans who are in prison?
Well, again, here we're dealing with numbers, and the challenge is, again, exponentially in Iowa, African Americans are about 3-4% of the population, yet in our representation in the prison population, ranks us close to the top. We were once at the top for the over-incarceration of African Americans, and that puts us at a number of about 11 to 1. So 11 times per capita. So that means percentage-wise, 11 times that for every one white person in prison per capita, there are 11 African Americans in prison per capita. So with that, obviously, that would support that if there are cases inside of prison that disproportionately those cases would be African-American. But also, I want to emphasize that those numbers are not all coming from prison and not mostly coming from prison. A large part of those numbers come from the fact that African-Americans, and this is also true for Latino-Americans, that they are essential workers, and essential workers being people that are working at your meat packing plants, in your food service, in your things that you have to do daily. So with that being said, those essential workers tend to, because they are interacting with people, catch this more. And we've seen that in our state. We've seen that with the Tyson plants. We've seen that with other food plants in our state. They're the reason why we're seeing high numbers in various parts of the state. Yes, there are some challenges in the prison system, and the governor has worked to release several hundred low-risk prisoners, as well as looking at other measures. So that definitely is one aspect, but it's certainly not the whole aspect. There's also data around pre-existing conditions that affect, and again, with the African-American population, there is a legacy of challenges within the health system, and a lot of that is based on, quite frankly, race, that legacy of race. And so when it comes to a health crisis, then less resources are available, less opportunities, as I said, less opportunities to even separate yourself and work at home or do something else. But if you're an essential worker, which also includes not only your doctors and your nurses and everything, which we are totally grateful for, but also those people that are cleaning behind the scenes, that are cleaning the rooms of the patients and things like that. So all of that plays into the challenges with African Americans and this disease.
Well, I guess the next question is, what can be done about that?
So we are, when you ask what can be done about that, the NAACP, obviously, the first step that we have taken, of course, is to take a look at those numbers. And those numbers are quite high. The first obtaining those numbers, and we've obtained those numbers. We're also providing education in the community. One of the things that we're doing, we are kicking off a 7-night series around next steps in COVID-19 in our community. So we're providing education to the community around this pandemic. And even though things are opening up, we want to make sure that people have the right information. So that's one of the things that we're doing. We're also pushing, I heard your last guest talk about science. We're absolutely pushing for the science and for the NAACP and other advocates. Those numbers are so important because they are the way to show people that we are not just making things up, that this is really happening. So we are using those numbers to show that. And then the other thing is, obviously we have to just make sure that not only our community is educated, but our government is educated. We are petitioning for a regular convening of a group of have a town hall series that is kicking off actually this evening on a Facebook Live at 6 p.m. Central Standard Time. We are going to be hosting our national office is going to provide. So tonight we'll be talking with our health director, Dr. Marjorie Innocent about the health, the issues at the core of this pandemic and how they relate for the African-American community. There are a number of myths out there that we will work to dispel. And then after that, we'll be talking about economics with our economic director. We'll be talking about civic engagement and voting and why that's important, why politics plays a role in pandemics. We'll be talking about education and the fact that our children were abruptly taken out of school and what that means. We know that they lose information over the summer, and this is kind of an extended summer, and many of our children have access to technology, and many of our children don't have access to technology. So we'll address that gap. We'll also talk about criminal justice. You mentioned our the concerns about this disease in the criminal justice system, and so we'll address that as well. And then we'll talk about the relationship between this and the environment. A lot of times when people are thinking about environmental efforts, they forget that people of color suffer the most when there's an episode. And I think about Flint, Michigan, or Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, and how those environmental events affected mostly people of color and mostly Black people. So we'll talk about those. And plus, we'll have a bonus town hall that's this Saturday. We'll have a bonus town hall with our national president, Derek Johnson. So our national president and CEO of the NAACP. And then we'll also have the U.S. Department of Justice and FBI and with hate crime experts. So we are really looking forward to presenting this series. It is, again, May 27th. Through the 30th is the first one, the first of the series. And then again, we'll come back on June 3rd through the 5th. So really, we're just really excited about this opportunity.
You said it's on Facebook Live. How can
Facebook, excuse me, fb.com/Iowa, Nebraska, NAACP.
Okay. We'll put that on our website as best we can. And thank you so much for being with us and telling us all these valuable things and what you're doing.
And well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, thanks. That was Betty Andrews, who is the Iowa, Nebraska president of the NAACP. And as she said, it's NAACP. That will be hosting a series of programs on the COVID-19 crisis as it affects African Americans in particular. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We have been talking with Betty Andrews, and now we'll be talking with someone about another manifestation of racism that most recently was on May 16, an attack of a 22-year-old man,
Darquan
Jones, who was simply walking in the night to visit his girlfriend in Des Moines. And three white men attacked him, leaving him with a broken arm, wrist, broken nose, a face broken in five places, and much more, including that they were pushing his head underwater when a couple of women who heard this cocked a gun, and that was enough for them to go away. In response to that violence, several community organizations joined together to hold an event last Saturday, noon at May 23rd, at the Evelyn K. Davis Park on the south side of Des Moines. One of the organizers of that event, Al Womble, president of the Democratic Black Caucus, is with us to tell us about it. Thanks for joining us, Al.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate this chance to speak with you and your audience.
Well, and your event actually was, the entire event was on your
Facebook page,
which was wonderful because we didn't actually get to see the crowd, but we could hear every speaker and get the full hour of that. And you were congratulated for doing that, putting it online so that people could share in it without being there. That came from someone who's often a guest here, State Representative Ross Wilburn. But someone else complained that they could see in the crowd that it was people weren't 6 feet apart, although the crowd was smaller than probably than it would have been. What were the organizations who sponsored it?
Well, there were several different organizations that came together in order to make that a reality. We had Surge show up for racial justice. We had the Iowa Democratic Black Caucus. We had Cameron Middlebrooks, who was there, who was president of the NAACP. So it was an amalgamation of many different organizations that came together in order to put it on. I don't know if it was necessarily sponsored, as you say, but we did use those organizations as a vehicle to help us organize individuals to be able to put that out there. And when we talk about the live event that was there in person, we actually had over 300 pin flags that were placed in the field at Evelyn K. Davis Park, all that were spaced at 8 feet distance from one another, that were put there by our volunteers. And the only individuals that we allowed to stand close to one another were people who cohabitated or lived together. So if you were a parent that came with your child, the two of you, since you're already cohabitating together, were allowed then to stay together in that area by the pin flags. We had over 100 people that showed up in person. We had almost 200 people viewing the event online. And it was something that was really, really exciting to me to see that so many people knew about this and decided they were going to come together to stand up for social justice and to stand up for this young man, Darquan, to make sure he receives justice. This issue is not merely swept under the rug. And as his father said, you know, imagine this happening to your own child, but this incident should have happened to no child, to no one, no matter who they are. And that's part of what we were trying to bring to light that day, that these sort of acts of violence, hatred, racism, bigotry must be stopped, but it can only be stopped once we all come together, and that no one should have to suffer through that kind of violence, humiliation, and receive physical and mental scars which will last their life.
Yes, and you had, I think I heard someone talking about a visit to the mayor of Des Moines and the city council. Did that happen?
I believe there is one planned. I'm not involved in that particular instance, but I will say that I'm very grateful for so many people who attended the event in person as well as online. You mentioned my good friend Ross Wilburn, the state representative from up there in Ames. I know that he attended online, as did Jamie Fitzgerald, Polk County Auditor. Mayor Frank County was there in person himself. So was State Senator Claire Salcy was there. We had United States Senate candidates Eddie Morrow and Kimberly Graham were also there in person. We greatly appreciated that. And so the outpouring of support from different leaders in the community was very wonderful to see. And I know that there is going to be continuing conversations about this, which are led by some of our different leaders in the community, including Cameron Middlebrooks from the Des Moines branch of the NAACP, State Representative Akail Abdul-Samad, and others. So we're hoping to make sure that we see this issue get resolved, and also that we see more people stand up against, unfortunately, what seems to be a rising tide of acts of racism and bigotry.
Yes, and it's very heartening to see that there are so many different organizations. And I noticed that there were even more that you mentioned, and even then it said, and others. So people from all over the town, all kind of groups are supporting your efforts to bring this horrible act of racism and hatred. There was a lot of talk at the beginning about the importance of love over hate.
One of the quotes that I had used there was one from the great Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, who had said that darkness cannot defeat darkness. Only light can defeat darkness. And that hate cannot defeat hate, that only love can defeat hate. And love should be what brings us all together in order to defeat this terrible scourge. But I must say that, know, incidents like this shouldn't be the thing that moves us. This should be a movement that we carry year round, that we consistently do this in times of good and in times of struggle like we're facing right now. The struggle against the forces of hatred and bigotry should be one that we are consistently vigilant at throughout the year. And I think that what I'm seeing here, unfortunately, you know, I was on another show yesterday and was talking to somebody about how we're all concerned about flattening the curve. And, you know, the great Betty Andrews and her work on trying to enlighten people about COVID-19 is tremendous. But, you know, we have another pandemic that we are facing, and that is a pandemic of racism and violence. And that curve is still going up. We look about what happened to that, you know, young man who was bird watching in New York. And then we see the horrible death of that young man up in Minneapolis. We see what happened to Ahmaud Arbery. We see that, you know, there are different sporadic acts of violence and hatred that happen here in Des Moines. And sometimes, you know, close personal friends of mine have been threatened with violence. This is a curve we also need to be concerned about flattening this pandemic of violence and racism that is affecting us right now. And I'm glad to be able to have a chance to speak with your radio listeners and to, you know, encourage people. Let us join together. Let us become brothers and sisters in this fight against injustice and against bigotry and racism. That's how we will finally defeat it, when we come together.
Well, thank you so much. This was Al Womble, who's been with us from the Democratic Black Caucus, and which is an organization I had first thought that this was like a congressional caucus, but this is a much broader caucus than that, right, Al?
Yes, the Iowa Democratic Black Caucus is a part of the Iowa Democratic Black Party. We encourage anyone and everyone to join. You don't have to be black to be a member of the Iowa Democratic Black Caucus. You just have to be someone who cares about issues that are affecting black people. And there is a black legislative caucus that is led by State Representative Roz Smith. And contains all five members of the House that are members of the black community. Representative Akhil Abdul-Samad, the great Representative Ross Wilburn, Representative Phyllis Thede, and Representative Ruth Ann Gaines.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Al. And thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Mr. Womble.
As we say goodbye to Al Womble, let's play a little music from the event, No Hate in Our State.
You always got to choose.
last guest today brings us a little bit of local history about an unmarked grave of a former slave in an Iowa graveyard. Sarah Jordan Hines discovered it and wrote a newspaper article to bring attention to the forgotten man.
Now, we're happy that Sarah could be here with us today to tell us the story. Welcome, Sarah.
Good morning.
Please tell us how you discovered the grave and what you learned about it before you wrote your first article.
Sure. So this is in Marshalltown when I was writing for the Times Republican newspaper. And this story dates to May of 2016. And I did quite a few articles out at Riverside Cemetery in Marshalltown. It's just really great fodder for historical articles. Lots of fascinating people are buried there. There's about 23,000 burials. And I was out there in February of 2016 doing research for a Black History Month article on a man named Thomas Cottomus, who remarkably was able to join up with an all-white regimen during the Civil War and made his way to Iowa and eventually Marshalltown. And he had a very basic headstone that was pretty weathered and aged through the years. And the cemetery staff was able to get him a VA-issued headstone as a replacement. And this was around Veterans Day 2015. So this was my first article. But while I was out at the cemetery doing research, they said that there was a man named Josiah French that was buried right next to Thomas Cottomus. But he did not have a headstone. And for as long as they knew, his grave had been unmarked. And so I decided to regroup and then do a follow-up story on Josiah. And he died in Marshalltown in 1892. And I read about him in some archives in the Marshalltown paper that at the time of his death, he was estimated to be between 70 and 90 years old. He did not know himself. And I found that quite poignant. That's something we all take for granted, knowing our birthday, that this man didn't know. And so I decided to dig through some archives that were in our newspaper archives, as well as the cemetery, and just some general Google searching to do an article about Josiah. And I talked about how, in addition to his Civil War service, he'd actually served in the Mexican-American War. But bear in mind, as more of a servant to his master. So a lot of African Americans and other minority groups served in these wars, but in unofficial capacities. And so that's why when he died, he was not eligible for a military government-issued headstone. Josiah had never formally enlisted with the Union Army. What really happened, as far as we can tell, is that runaway slaves, if you will, joined up with Union soldiers to take refuge with them, almost like claiming contraband. And then Josiah moved back up north to Iowa with these soldiers and started a new life after the Civil War. And even though he didn't have this government headstone, he is buried in the GAR plot of Riverside Cemetery, known as the Grand Army of the Republic. It's a fraternal organization that was made up of Civil War veterans.
And so how did he get his headstone then?
Yes. So my intention of writing this article 4 years ago was to drum up some community interest and perhaps GoFundMe, do something where people would maybe donate $10 here, $20 there, and we could get him a headstone. But fate intervened, and just a few days after my article ran, a man emailed me. He said he'd been traveling to Marshalltown on business and just picked up the morning paper and read my article and was so touched by this story that he said he would cover the entire cost of the headstone, but wished to remain anonymous.
Well, I've seen pictures of that headstone. I think it's a beautiful headstone. I believe it's the way the GAR headstones are, right? Is that?
Well, so this anonymous donor had said we could design it and to keep it looking fairly like the others. He didn't want this one to necessarily be ostentatious or overshadow the other headstones. So the cemetery's general manager, Dori Taman, whom I worked with frequently for articles, she designed the font or the lettering on the headstone to make it especially readable and appealing to the eye. And then Civil War historian and volunteer at the cemetery, Jerry McCann, who was a great help for the article, he wrote the epitaph, which reads, unknown for the birth date, to 1892, born in slavery, died in freedom, honored here by the soldiers whose hardships he shared. And then my contribution to the project is I picked out the actual headstone, which is kind of a hybrid between one that lays flat to the ground and one that's completely standing. So it kind of slants. I thought it would be nice if you were driving or on the path out there that you could see it pretty easily. So it was quite a team effort. And by the time the design got done, things were paid for, you know, kind of crossing the T's, dotting the I's, it was November of 2016 that the headstone was actually installed in the GAR plot.
So very close to Veterans Day.
Yes, yes. And readers had wondered if we would do some kind of ceremony to honor the installation, but that didn't come to fruition for whatever reason. But you can visit the grave any time during the cemetery's business hours. It's fairly easy to find.
Well, thank you, Sarah. This, I think that Iowa's role in the Civil War is not well known, but you might know we have the most deaths for our population. Is that?
Yes, I had heard that. Yeah, it's very interesting, and I think it speaks well of this infantry that took Josiah, and I think he did kind of more manual labor, cooking, just kind of helping take care of the soldiers. And they said, come back to Iowa with us and start this new life. There's not a lot known about Josiah's personal life, but, you know, kind of reading between the lines, as you often have to do with history, is even though he wasn't technically an enlisted soldier, his friends and colleagues wanted his final resting place to be in that GAR plot. And that alone gave some extra prestige, and some of the pallbearers at his funeral were quite prominent citizens of Marshalltown at the time. And just how respected he was really heartening to see.
Oh, thank you.
We've just heard from Sarah Jordan Heitz telling the story of the long overdue headstone and acknowledgement for Francis Josiah French's service in the Civil War.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people's stories and events in Central Iowa. We've been your hosts, Susan Franzen and Pat Schlarbaum. Today's guests were Carolyn Raffensperger, Petty Andrews, Al Womble, and
Sarah Jordan Heitz.
And it's certainly nice to co-host with you, Susan. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m. And at noon today, Local Talk will present a special program from the Ames Public Library. To brighten your spirits and those of any children who might be living with you, you can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories.
Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD,
The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. And thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.